This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Josh Healy, who served as the Progressive's spoken word editor last year. Josh is the author of a book of his own poems entitled Hammer Time. He's the co-founder of the First Wave program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which was the first college hip-hop arts program in the nation. He currently lives in Oakland and works with Youth Speaks to empower young artists and activists across the Bay Area and beyond. Josh Healy, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Well, it's great to see you again, and I just wanted to thank you again for spending time with me a year and a half ago and stressing the importance of the Progressive reaching a younger audience, for one thing, and the importance of spoken word in general for another, and also for introducing me to your own poems, which I read that day once you handed me a copy and took off. So I enjoyed that whole experience, and it's nice to see you again. Why don't you give the listener in the car that person's driving, or in the kitchen, or in the person's office, you know, a little background, where'd you grow up, and how'd you get interested in all this stuff?
For sure. So I grew up born and raised in Washington, D.C., right in the belly of the beast, and I got started as a poet the same year I got started as a political activist, which was my junior year of high school. But it was really my senior year in high school that it all kind of cemented. I was a senior, 17 years old, in D.C. when 9/11 happened.
And so how did you first hear about 9/11 then? Where were you?
I was in Mr. McConnell's chemistry class, second period, when we heard a plane had hit the World Trade Center, and a plane had hit soon after the Pentagon. And the first thing that came to my mind was my mom. My mom works two blocks from the White House. And there were reports of car bombs going off. That was just a crazy day. Luckily, you know, she was fine. Everyone I knew was fine. But I went to the largest public high school in D.C., where we had kids who had family who did work at the Pentagon.
Did people just split class from that chemistry class? Did people just run out? What happened?
No, they kept us in there at first because they didn't want kids going out outside, and we watched TV. We watched TV, and we sat there and were quiet. And this was before the age of everyone having cell phones. So I didn't have a cell phone, so I didn't have a way to call anyone. But eventually they let us out of school, and I went home, and, you know, my mom got home and all that. But I remember this in terms of how I got started as a writer and as an activist because, like I was saying, we had friends who had family at the Pentagon. Also at my school, we had students from Afghanistan and students from a big Middle East population at my high school. And so we had it right there in my senior class. And 2 weeks after 9/11, September 25th, I remember it, we had the first ever open mic at my high school where you could come and share your poetry, your thoughts, really just anything. And 500 students came, packed into a room not that much larger than this studio we're in right now, and shared their raps, their songs, everything for peace. And out of that, it was the most diverse thing I'd ever seen. My school was very diverse, but very segregated. It's America. It's D.C. It is what it is. And it was the first thing I'd seen where people were honest and political and vulnerable in a way with each other that I'd never seen before. And out of that open mic came the first The first peace march in D.C. after 9/11, a lot of people don't know this, was led by high school students. And it was three high schools, and my high school is one of them, and we organized out of that open mic. So for me, being a poet has always been tied to being an activist. They're one and the same. And I came to Madison to go to school, and here we are today.
And you wrote a poem about being in Madison at a different kind of protest.
Mm-hmm.
This was the... well, why don't you talk about that protest and read that poem?
For sure. So this is a poem that I wrote in 2006 at the height of the burgeoning, resurgent immigrant rights movement in response to another crazy right-wing Wisconsin Republican, Jim Sensenbrenner, who proposed the anti-immigration bill in Congress. And there was this national movement that arose. And it arose in L.A., there were a million people demonstrating. In Chicago, there were a million people. But in Madison, Wisconsin, a place you don't think of as a large immigrant community, there was this huge demonstration, one of the biggest since the Vietnam era. So I wrote this poem in honor of that, my thoughts on that. So this is called At the May Day March 2006. The American flag never looked so beautiful, so much like reparations. 25,000 cotton dreams stitched together, ready to take over the sweatshop. The Capitol sits atop Ho-Chunk burial ground. Pilgrims and Packers, now called Native, but we Americans are here to honor ancestors who want bread and justice for their children. If 50 stars can be seen above Walmart in Mexico, an embassy in Iraq, we can take it back. She can take it back. She is walking beside me. Lifts both hands calloused to the clouds, moves her feet quicker than the police, shouts with joy and teeth as we reach the rally point. Democratic senators and Latino business owners take turns vowing not to exploit her tomorrow. But today, May Day, she celebrates the removal of borders around her spirit, the coming out of a community, Latin America on the march, strong, brown, and proud all the way in Wisconsin. I widen my gaze, see the maze of Madison coming together. This looks like a movement, like Haymarket in 86, like Jesse in 88. This is the Rainbow Coalition, forged every May 1st, from London to Jakarta. Chicago kicked off the party but forgot the anniversary, so the world came to us to show some solidarity. And I want to ask my fellow marcher, as her hands grasp the stars, what do you need from me? How can we build from here? Where is this going? But the path doesn't clear easy between us. One march doesn't teach me Spanish, and it doesn't rewrite laws. We may not speak the same tongue, but we sing for one common cause. And the song goes, let us remember this day. Let us remember the weather, how warm it was when we walked together. Let us remember how we found the melody and the accents of our abuelos and bubbies. Let us remember why we fought, why we held that flag and carried those signs. Let us remember and let us remake every day like that one May Day when we first joined in stride.
That's Josh Healy reading At the May Day Rally, March 2006, from his poetry book, Hammer Time. And Josh Healy is living in Oakland, California now, and he works with a group called Youth Speaks. Tell me about that.
Youth Speaks, basically, we believe in voice. We believe in the importance of real free speech, and that one of the groups that's most often denied free speech in our country is young people. At schools, at home, in confrontations with the police often, the first thing that young people are often told is, shut up, be quiet, conform. You see this now in policy through things like standardized testing are just a standardized version of shut up, be quiet, fill in the bubble. And we believe that to find your voice, to speak, to develop as a writer, as a poet, and as a speaker is a first step to being an engaged activist citizen. So I do writing workshops. I do poetry workshops. I do activism workshops with young people all throughout the Bay Area in California. And through our Brave New Voices network, we work with folks all over. And it's really, it's about having a cultural front. It's about every social movement. You can't reach people just through the brain. You need the heart. And you hear something in a poem, in a song, in a creative sign at a rally that someone made with their own art that you won't hear in a speech. And you need both. And so my thing is to help generate the next generation of Allen Ginsbergs and Langston Hughes's and Paul Robesons and Chuck D's and whoever else we need as artistic revolutionaries.
I'm speaking with Josh Healy. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. And so what has the response been from the young people, and how young are these young people? What's the range?
We mostly work with high school age, but all the way from middle school up through college, and also teachers. And, you know, we have Youth Speaks. We also have Elder Speaks that we do sometimes too. The response is huge. The response is the demand for our programs is bigger than the supply. Similarly, here in Madison with the First Wave program, you know, they can't keep up with the demand. The reason being, spoken word is this very democratic art form, radically democratic. That's the whole point. It's bringing poetry from the ivory tower back to the people, where it started. Poetry started as an oral tradition.
Because poetry, when I was taught in high school, was anything but for the people, and it was just about as most obscure and off-putting as you could find. It was just designed for just a, you know, graduate school English majors who want to decipher the Greek and Latin from Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot.
And that's still the majority of it in academia. That's still the majority of it pretty much in most high schools. And that's why I think the kids respond, is because this is saying basically what we say is our teaching method is based off of Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, with the idea that of life, your life, as a primary text.
I mean, in a way, June Jordan was a spoken word artist before there was spoken word.
Poetry for the people. Yeah. And, you know, June Jordan and Poetry for the People is one of the kind of precursors to Youth Speaks in the Bay Area, and she's one of the mothers of the spoken word movement, as is folks like Amiri Baraka, Sonia Sanchez, Ginsberg, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I did an event with Lawrence Ferlinghetti a month ago at City Lights Books in San Francisco. He's 95, and the number one selling book in City Lights and at half the bookstores around the country is still Coney Island of the Mind. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti, he was more radical than any of my teenagers, and they were just loving it. And he's a youth at heart. He's 95, and he's a big supporter because he knows that more important than your line breaks or your stanzas, which are important, we teach the craft, I've learned craft, more important than that is the spirit. Is the essence. What are you trying to say? Why are you trying to say it? Who are you for? Who do you stand with?
I mean, because poetry at bottom is communicating to people, and it was one of the first means of communication that people had thousands of years ago.
It's storytelling, and for me, I'm a storyteller and a trash talker. Those are kind of my two main things that I do other than organize events and political things here and there. I talk a lot of trash and I tell a lot of stories. They overlap, and spoken word is one of the ways that I'm able to do that without getting smacked in the face.
And these people you work with, these young people, must feel liberated and validated because there's been a lot of them being put down and told to shut up.
Yeah. I mean, there's a personal empowerment. The first step is finding your own voice, realizing that your voice is valid, that your life is valid. That's when you say your voice is valid, it means I mean something. You know, as I am somebody, I am a man, or the signs back in the 60s. I am a person. I am a poet. That's the first step. Then the second step is getting them to see the collective bigger than themselves. You start with self, build to community. And so that's why you see a lot of spoken word does have a very community-oriented focus.
And so do you have spoken word competitions and slam poetry competitions?
Yeah, we Youth Speaks holds the largest youth poetry slam in the country. Over 3,000 people attend our finals each year at the San Francisco Opera House. We try and take the form to the high venues and show them, you know, this is high art too. Or even if it's not, this is our house too.
Was there resistance to that at the Opera House?
They love us. They love us. They similar to, you know, the event I'm in town tonight in Madison is at the Overture Center.
Which is a real stuffy place. But.
It's stuffier than as stuffy as you can get. But they need audiences, and they need young audiences. They know that arts audiences are, you know, Medicare and up, and you need to have young people, and, you know, the symphony ain't going to cut it. And so they understand it. Sometimes they get nervous and they have too many security guards, and we tell them to chill and back off. Everything's going to be cool.
Speaking with Josh Healy, he is the co-founder of the First Wave program at the University of Wisconsin, and now out in Oakland, California, works with a group called Youth Speaks and Brave New Voices, working with young artists and activists doing spoken word across the Bay Area and beyond the Bay Area. And he's been instrumental in opening my eyes, anyway, to this potential of spoken word. I've seen some on television, and I've interviewed a few poets in this studio who have been powerful influences too. But you know, I'm a 52-year-old white guy. I don't go out and see a lot of poetry slam contests. But I should get off my ass and do that more, because we've always liked poetry at the Progressive, at least since I've been editor there, and we publish an original poem every month, and it's got to be political in one degree or another. And so this is another way of getting that kind of art to people.
And I want to just shout out, you know, one of the poets you've had in particular, which is Martina Spada, who has been one of my biggest influences as a writer. And I first heard him, I think, when you brought him to Madison 4, 5, or 6 years ago. And I got to hear him. And it's important, just as political activists, to know our history. As artists, you got to know your artistic history. And so that's one of the things that I've learned and try and pass down when I can.
Yeah. And I'd recommend to anyone, Martina Spada. So if you're listening to this program and you can remember his name, he is an incredible, powerful poet. He has a beautiful baritone. So if you can ever hear him read, it's a powerful experience. He has a 9/11 poem that is absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can just pick up his poems, too, the last name is Espada, Martina Spada. So that's worth getting a listen to or taking a read of. You've written about and thinking a lot about the labor uprising in Wisconsin, Josh Healy. And I wanted to hear your views as someone who's been in Wisconsin and now is away from Wisconsin about the significance of this uprising and how to understand it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say we were talking about this right before we got on, but I live in California, and I was at the rally last week in solidarity with Wisconsin. 1,000 people in downtown Oakland on a Monday, which you don't get that crowd usually at any time of the week, let alone downtown on a Monday during the day. Anytime anyone even said the word Wisconsin, even they said whisk before they could even get all the syllables out, the crowd went crazy. It's about time. It's about time some people fought back. And thank you. It was a thank you roar. It was a thank you. And I know that it's tough, and I know that victory is not... We didn't win everything, and we didn't lose everything, and I don't know what we won and what we lost, but we're fighting. And when I would be getting my news about the Wisconsin thing, mostly via Facebook or Twitter, as we were talking about, from progressive writers or from my friends on Facebook, and I would see my old friends in Madison, my old students, 18, 19, 20 years old, who would normally be writing about who was on American Idol or who won the football game. And everything was, I can't believe what this guy Walker is doing, what the governor is doing, and I'm heading up to the Capitol right now. Who's coming with me? And then you'd see 100 comments that would be, I'm coming, I'm coming, I'm coming. What it all means is people decided it was too much. It was too far. It was too blatant. And in California, where I live now, where we have budget cuts upon budget cuts upon budget cuts, last year the teachers went on strike. It was a one-day strike. What does a one-day strike do? It does nothing. They know you're going to end. It's like one time I was part of a hunger strike that was a three-day hunger strike. How do you have a hunger strike for 3 days? They know you're going to end it. It doesn't mean anything. What happened in Madison was it kept going. No one knew what was going to stop. It was popular. It was spontaneous. And it hasn't, the movement, you know, is changing, but it's given people hope, not just for Wisconsin, but for themselves. I see my folks in Oakland, the teachers who went on the one-day strike are now like, we need to step our game up. You need models.
Josh Healy, you mentioned your mother. I know you come from a political family, and you've got a poem, a personal family poem that you wanted to read. We have about almost 6 minutes left. If you can read it, that would be great.
Okay, so this is about my family, and this is about another state, not Wisconsin, but another state that could use our solidarity right now. So this is for Arizona. Fedya, my great-grandpa, believed impossible. The only photo I have of him, a grainy black and white from the 1950s, taken in the L.A. backyard he shared with great-grandma Barbara, Grandma Dorothy, and my pops in South Central back when the neighborhood was poor white folks, migrants from Arkansas and Oklahoma, and one old communist from Bulgaria with a scraggly beard and a crazy smile. Fedya spent the last 10 years of his American life in that backyard trying to build a perpetual motion machine. A machine that once you started it would supposedly go on forever without new energy or adjustments, thus perpetual motion. Something that everyone from Isaac Newton to my fourth grade science teacher agreed was physically impossible. But not for Fedya, the sweet man with a curious smile. Born in Bulgaria but learned how to swim in the Pacific at the age of 5, he met my great-grandma walking along the beach, or maybe it was walking a picket line, both members of the party, and I'm not talking about the after party. I am a fourth-generation socialist. Red diaper great-grandbaby, the FBI's been wiretapping my family since before there were wiretaps. Now they just follow me on Twitter. Fedya was the dreamer. Barbara the fighter marched for striking miners in Colorado, migrant farm workers in California. She was a communist and proud of it. Thank you for asking. Lived in the city of angels, tried to create heaven here on American earth, from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs, she said. It sounded to me like kindergarten. She called it communism, a system folks said was physically impossible. But she and Fedya believed. Now, Joe McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover did not exactly share my family's beliefs. They believed in prophets and witch hunts and controlling suspected dreamers. In 1951, they showed up at my family's door in South Central. I can imagine the scene. Barbara sitting on the front porch, talking politics and playing cards with Grandma. My 8-year-old pop sitting on her lap, wondering what these fat men with black coats were doing walking through his lawn, but the feds weren't looking for anyone with a U.S. passport. They came around the back and went for Fedya and his foreign smile, busy putting what he was sure were the finishing touches on his machine. But he never saw those wheels and pulleys again. The FBI took him in steel cuffs, then sent him past the steel curtain to Bulgaria, a land he hadn't seen since he could crawl, a language he couldn't speak his own name, in a country called communist that traded the sickle for an AK against its own people. This is for Fedya. This is for Arizona, where they now deport any dreamer with brown skin. Where McCarthy is called Jan Brewer and J. Edgar is Sheriff Joe Arpaio, where they're trying to finish what Cali started with Prop 187, where they're banning ethnic studies because you shouldn't learn history from one group's side, but they still celebrate Columbus, where they were the last state in the country to honor MLK Day until a boycott and Chuck D put them on blast, where a congresswoman's supermarket is still cleaning blood from its aisles, and if you don't see the connections, you're listening to the wrong radio station. My heart is a Grand Canyon, gaping and breaking every time I hear the words, go back to Mexico. Sounds too much like go back to Russia, you freaking commie. They still scream at me on the picket line. Didn't you listen earlier? I told you I'm from Bulgaria and D.C., and Oakland, California, I know where I'm from, why my roots run red. Do you see the blood on your branches, the tears in your leaves? America is a tree standing by the water. Can she ever be moved? This land is a shtetl of liars and thieves and dreamers and kings. Grandfathers will always cross rivers. The grass looks more green. The only thing that is constant is movement. We are in perpetual motion, but we are never machines, so I dare you to try, because you can never deport a dream. This is for Fedya. I never got a chance to meet you. Taken from me like kindergarten ideals, they stole you from your wife, your family. But I'm here, Fedya. I'm coming back for you. Back to Bulgaria. Assimilated American in post-Soviet wasteland, I can see you sitting in the backyard of an old gray apartment, waiting for the wind to carry you a taste of the Pacific. I open the gate. You see me, and you see yourself. Same scraggly beard, same crazy smile. You're Richard's son, aren't you? Joshua. Yes, Fedya, it's me. I'm here. I have the wheels. I have the pulleys. Can you show me how to build impossible?
That's Josh Healy reading his poem, Arizona. We're out of time, Josh, but thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt.
It was wonderful.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.